Nicky, then. Dad had left them alone to find something called oil. Nick figured that it was something he had lost during the war. Mom said Dad was a bastard to leave them, but she mixed her words sometimes, and he thought she meant basket. A basket was a bad thing. She always made Nick promise not to be a basket when he grew up. Dad was a wildcatter, and all wildcatters were baskets, Mom said. The worst wildcatters came from Texas. Dad had come from Texas, and Mom met him in San Diego. That was during the war, when Dad was a CB, whatever that was. Then Mom and Dad got divorced because Dad was a basket. That was what divorce meant, when a dad goes away. One night, Mom left him with Gramps and Gran. She went out with Uncle Stan. Nick remembered that Mom and Uncle Stan were laughing and their breath smelled funny, like Billy. In the morning, he woke to find Gran sitting on his bed. Her eyes were puffy and red, and she hugged him close. He didn't like being held and tried to wriggle out of her grasp, but she held him tightly. "Oh, my poor boy," Gran cried, and Nick's heart beat wildly, like the wings of a trapped bird. He'd never seen Gran act this way before. He wrinkled his nose. Gran didn't smell like Mom. She smelled old. She told him there had been an accident, and he was afraid she was going to punish him. Sometimes he had an accident at night and woke up with a bed wet and smelling of pee-pee, and Mom would get mad at him. She told him that Mom was dead. Uncle Stan, too. She said dead meant that Mom had gone away to be with Jesus in heaven. He asked Gran when Mom was coming back, and she just shook her head and hugged him again. She asked him if he understood, and he said yes. Mom had gone away. That's what grown-ups did. They went away. When he went down for breakfast, he looked around for Mom, just in case she might have come back. He looked all over the house, but he couldn't find her. The next day, they dressed him in a suit and tie and took him to the funeral home. They said Mom was in a box by the altar, but Gran wouldn't let him look. She said it wasn't really Mom in the coffin. Mom was in heaven. They drove to the cemetery in a big black car. The minister, a tall, skinny man with a funny nasal voice, talked about peace and heaven, and Gran cried. Nick looked down the green slope towards the freeway. The grass was speckled with white markers like stone sheep. The lanes of traffic shimmered in the smoggy sunlight, and on a distant billboard, a man and woman embraced against a giant cigarette package. The minister picked up a handful of dirt and poured it into Nick's hand. He told Nick to throw it into the grave. Nick pressed away from the grave, afraid that if he went too close to the edge, he would fall in and be locked in the earth forever. The minister took his hand and tried to make him throw the dirt. Nick's snub-nosed face became contorted, and he bared his teeth like a wolf cub. He threw the dirt in the minister's face. The minister stood there blinking stupidly as Gramps took Nick's hand and led him back to the car. From then on, he lived with Gran and Gramps. Esmeralda, the maid, took him to the nursery every day. At dinner, he had to sit still and not speak until spoken to. One night, Gran said she wouldn't have that man in her house, and Nick's heart began to pound. He somehow knew, although he didn't know how, that they were speaking about his father. Gran didn't like his father. She said his neck was red, and he made loud noises when he ate. She looked disgusted when she said that, like the time when he had found a garter snake in the garden. It was a question of breeding, Gran said, looking pointedly at Nick. You were supposed to keep your mouth closed and chew each bite properly. That showed you had good manners. That night, Nick lay awake for a long time, wondering what his father looked like and whether he really had a red neck. Rain pattered against his bedroom window, and he wondered if it would flood and carry his mother out to sea forever. He began to cry. Then Gran came in and told him about heaven until he began to yawn and fell asleep. In the morning, a strange man came to the house. They were having breakfast in Gran's breakfast nook when Esmeralda came in and said there was a Mr. Tim Curry at the door. Nick smiled. That was funny because Curry was his name, too. He was Nick Curry. Gran looked at Gramps. the man came into the breakfast room. Esmeralda looked at Gramps, who dismissed her with a wave of his hand. The man had very broad shoulders, dark curly hair, and gray eyes. His face was dark as an Indian's from the sun, and Nick craned his head to see if the man's neck was really red like Gran said. "I've come for my boy, Marjorie," the man said in a quiet voice, but he wasn't looking at Gran. He was looking at Nick. No one had ever looked at him like that, and he felt uncomfortable. "It's a little late for that now," Gran said. "Hello, Nick. I'm your father," the man said with a smile. It was a nice smile, and Nick felt his face grow red. "What Elizabeth ever saw in you?" Gran said. "It was the war," the man said simply, as though that explained everything. "I have to tell you that I've already spoken with my attorney. We're taking steps to secure legal custody," Gramps said. Gramps stood up. "He's my son," the man said. "You should have thought of that before. Neglecting Elizabeth so you could go tramping all over the world. If you'd stayed where you belonged, none of this would have happened," Gran said, her face twisted like someone about to cry. Her eyes were hard and bright as diamonds. "Elizabeth wouldn't let me see him, you know that," the man said, wearily shaking his head. "I want you out of this house now, Tim, or I'm calling the police. If you have anything to say, you can say it in court," Gramps said, crossing to the phone. But the man was quicker than Gramps. He grabbed the phone and jerked it out of the wall. "It'll take more than courts or the police, Wallace. It'd take a fucking army to keep me from my boy," the man growled. Nick swallowed hard. The man had used a bad word. "Get out of here, you redneck," Gran hissed. The man scooped up Nick as easily as if he were a football. His arms and chest were thick and hard as a tree trunk. Nick peered at the back of the man's neck, and sure enough, it was red, just like Gran said. "Don't try to stop me, Wallace. Don't anyone try to stop me," the man said, turning to go. Nick clung to the man like a monkey to a tree. On their way out, the man yanked the hall phone from the wall. That was fun. Nick had never seen that done before. The man carried him to a car, and as they drove away, the man asked him, "Have you ever been on a plane, Nick?" Nick shook his head. "Well, we're going on a plane, little boy. And it's going to fly so high that all the houses and cars will look like tiny little toys," the man smiled. "We're going to a magical land with more wonderful things than you can imagine. And there's oil there, more oil than anyone knows, the greatest treasure in the world. I can smell it, boy," the man declared with a wink and a sly tap on his nose. Nick laughed. Later on the plane, Nick looked down and saw the houses and cars were small as toys, and the people were so tiny he couldn't even see them. The man didn't look out of the window. He just smoked his pipe and kept glancing at Nick. And once, he grabbed Nick and held him tight. He smelled like tobacco. It was a good smell. "I love you, Nick. There hasn't been a day that's gone by that I haven't thought of you," the man whispered in a thick voice. Nick felt warm all over. It felt good. Except that now his father was dead. They all were. The black-robed riders had dismounted and were running towards him. He didn't know what to do. There'd never been a time when there wasn't a grown-up around to tell him what to do. The men with the guns came closer, and he was afraid. He turned and began to run. One of the terrible black-robed figures chased him. Nick ran wildly without direction, half-blinded by the sweat stinging his eyes. Around him, the sandy plain lay flat and endless and blinding white as a linen-covered table. Glancing over his shoulder, he saw the Arab only a few steps behind him, stabbing the air with a long, curved dagger. Nick ran even harder, but it was hard running in the sand, and he stumbled. He scrambled on all fours like a monkey, and then a hand yanked him off his feet. He looked up to see the black figure towering above him, the knife blade glittering like fire in the sun. Nick closed his eyes. His ears filled with roaring, like the sound of the surf near Gramps' house on the Palos Verdes shore. His body tensed for the blow, but nothing happened. At last he opened his eyes. the Arab lay beside him in the sand. In the center of his forehead was a small black hole oozing blood. It looked like a third eye. He became aware of the sound of gunfire. He saw an Arab bending over his dad suddenly straighten up and then crumple to the ground. The black-robed Arabs were running away. Nick turned in the direction of the gunfire, but he couldn't see who was firing. The desert was empty all the way to the horizon. When he turned back, the black-robed figures had mounted their horses, spurring them into a desperate gallop. They fled like shadows, disappearing in the blinding light. Nick ran back to his dad, who was lying there exactly as Nick had left him. Nick had never felt so alone. "Who's going to take care of me now?" he wondered. In the far distance, he could see black specks approaching. As they drew closer, he saw that they were Arabs riding on camels. The Arabs approached slowly, as in a dream. The heat haze made it look like the camels were running through water, but he knew there was no water in the desert. It was hard to know what was real. Now he could see the Arabs clearly. They wore brown robes and carried rifles strung with fringes. Nick pulled the Boy Scout knife his dad had given him from his pocket and opened it. He would kill anyone who tried to touch his dad. The Arab on the lead camel drew to a halt and looked around. His face was dark and wrinkled like a walnut. His curly beard was speckled black and white, and he had a big hooked nose like a bird's beak. The camel began to sink down on its haunches, rocking back and forth like a boat as it settled to the ground. The Arab slid easily to the ground and stood before Nick. "Inglesi?" the Arab asked.
"What?"
Nick said.
"You...
English?" the Arab said, pointing at Nick.
"We're... American,"
Nick stammered. "Americans were the best," Gramps always said. The Arab nodded and began to approach Nick's dad.
"Don't touch my daddy!"
Nick screamed, his voice thin and wild as a bird's cry. His grip tightened on the knife. The Arab seemed not to have heard and began to kneel by the body. Nick struck.
"Ya Allah!"
the Arab cried, jerking his hand away. It dripped with blood from the wound. One of the other Arabs aimed his rifle at Nick.
"La!"
the Arab cried, throwing up his wounded hand and jumping into the line of fire. "The boy showed courage protecting his own, as a man should. Besides, we are Muslims, the Khalifa of Allah on earth. A Muslim does not make war on children," he said in Arabic. Then in English to Nick. "Do not be afraid, little scorpion," thereby conferring the nickname that was to stay with the boy. "Those who attacked you were Saar, the wolves of the desert. They are our enemies, too. I am Sheikh Zayed ibn Bushir of the Mutayar. All that you see is my dira," flinging his arm out wide as if to display the desert like a painting. Zayed squatted down and looked levelly at Nick, his eyes soft and very brown. "Put away your sting, little scorpion. I am bound by God to protect you," Zayed said. Nick looked distrustfully at the Arab.
"You won't hurt my daddy?"
he asked tremulously, his chin trembling on the verge of sobbing. Zayed looked at the body.
"No one can hurt your Baba anymore," Zayed said.
The two regarded each other for a long moment. Then Nick folded the knife and stuck it in his pocket.
"You are a Dhimmi, a child of the book?" Zayed asked.
"I don't know," Nick shrugged.
Zayed pondered, as though considering a knotty problem. Finally, he shook his head and stood up.
"Where is your mama?"
"She died and went to heaven,"
Nick said, eager to answer a question he understood. Zayed smiled with approval. A child who believed in heaven was obviously not a pagan.
"You are orphan," Zayed said, pointing at Nick.
"I don't know,"
Nick said uncomfortably. He didn't want to be an orphan. One time, Gramps had let him stay up to watch a movie about orphans on TV. It was called Oliver Twist. Orphans had to wear rags and eat awful stuff called gruel. People were mean to orphans.
The Messenger of Allah, blessed is his name, taught us to protect the orphan, Zaid declared. He looked down at Nick with his kind eyes, then turned and walked towards his camel.
Come, you can't stay here. You would die in the desert, Zaid said.
Nick stood by his dad, uncertain.
Come, little scorpion. You will be hungry, he said, and mounted his camel.
Nick trudged over to the camel. It turned its great head towards him and drew back its lips, as if it would bite him. Nick froze, afraid to come closer.
Don't be afraid, little scorpion, Zaid said.
Zaid leaned down and stretched out his arm. He took Nick's little hand in his and pulled him up. He struck the camel lightly on the neck with his riding whip. The camel rose awkwardly in stages, like a beam being jimmied up. Zaid struck her again and called, Hat-hat-hat! Nick almost laughed, because it sounded like he was saying hot-hot-hot, and they were off. At twilight, the men of the Mutayir lined up their prayer rugs and bowed their heads towards the dying red sun that lay in the direction of the Qibla, which is towards Mecca. After the Maghrib prayers, everyone joined Sheikh Zaid in his tent for dinner. They ate chunks of roasted lamb on a bed of rice called shawirmu, served on a single great round brass tray, and dipped pieces of pita bread in bowls of ful and goat's milk cheese called gibna bedamin. Everyone reached into the same bowls with his fingers. Sheikh Zaid plucked choice morsels of lamb and fed Nick with his own hand. The meat was hot. Sheikh Zaid's son, Yusef, who at 10 was much bigger than Nick, taught Nick to reach for the food with his right hand only. The left hand was used to wipe yourself after you went to the toilet, except the only toilet was a hole in the sand. Yusef explained this to Nick in clumsy English and a pantomime that had all the men laughing. After eating, a veiled woman served thick coffee in a copper pot with a long curved spout and disappeared behind a woven curtain. Then they sat and listened to old Muhammad recite from the Quran from memory. Nick sat on the woven rug with his legs stuck out straight in front of him. He looked around the tent. From the outside, the tent was made of plain black cloth, but inside it was hung with colorful woven rugs, the tent poles festooned with brightly dyed woven hangings. Behind one of the rugs, he could hear the clatter and murmur of the women as they cleaned the dishes. The sound of the wind outside was woven into the drone of Muhammad's recitation, as much a part of the saying as the words themselves. The tent ropes creaked in the night. It sounded like a boat in the middle of the sea. By the noonday brightness, and by the night when it darkens, thy Lord hath not forsaken thee, neither hath he been displeased. Surely the future shall be better for thee than the past. And in the end he shall be bounteous to thee, and thou shalt be satisfied. Did he not find thee an orphan, and give thee a home, erring and guided thee, needy and enriched thee? Yusef translated the words for Nick in a whisper. The stuff about the orphan was about him, Nick thought, and remembered his dad.
And the vein, Habibi, tell us of the vein, Zaid said to Muhammad.
The old man raised his eyes soulfully to the top of the tent and recited,
Is he not closer than the vein of thy neck? Thou needest not raise thy voice, for he knoweth the secret whisper, and what is yet more hidden, he knows what is in the land and in the sea. No leaf falleth, but he knoweth it. Nor is there a grain in the darkness under the earth, nor a thing green or sere, but it is recorded.
Yusef noticed the way Nick was sitting with his legs splayed out in front of him and tapped his leg sharply.
To show a man the soles of your feet is to insult him, Yusef whispered.
He showed Nick how to sit cross-legged. Nick frowned. There was a lot to learn. Directly across from him, a teenager with a thin, scraggly mustache and a cast in one eye was staring at Nick, his eyes narrowed. His lips were thin and tight as a knife edge.
Who's that?
Nick asked.
That is Bandar, son of my father's younger half-brother, Faraj. You should not have pointed your feet at him. Now he is your enemy, Yusef whispered.
I didn't mean it,
Nick whispered back, a lump in his throat.
It's too late. You must remember you are not alone. If you bring dishonor on yourself, you also dishonor your family and your entire tribe, Yusef said. Who is my tribe?
That is yet to be decided, Yusef replied. The old man had finished his recitation. Sheikh Zayed took out a pouch, rolled a cigarette, and lit it. Then Bandar spoke.
There is a kafir among us, he said, his good eye glaring at Nick.
Sheikh Zayed exhaled a thin stream of smoke, which curled in the air like strands of hair.
The messenger of Allah said, when any man says to his brother, thou infidel, one of the two deserves the name.
That is a true hadith of Bukhari from Abdullah ibn Umar, Zayed replied mildly.
The little Dimi is not my brother, Bandar reported hotly.
The child is an orphan. We saved him from the Tsar dogs in the desert. Are we not bound? Zayed asked, addressing himself to all of them.
Faraj, a thin man with a beard but no mustache, straightened his back and placed his hands on his knees.
The boy is Jajaur. Better to remove the stone of offense, my brother, Faraj said in a troubled voice.
Perhaps he felt called upon to defend his son, Bandar.
What says the Holy Quran?
Zayed appealed to Muhammad. The old man closed his eyes and spoke in a clear voice.
They will question thee concerning the orphans. Say, to set their affairs aright is good. And if you intermix with them, they are your brothers.
There were nods of agreement around the tent. Nick yawned. He was growing sleepy, but he tried to stay awake. They were talking about him. He looked at the bejeweled Kanjar dagger in Sheikh Zayed's belt. It was very pretty. He wondered if he could have a knife, too.
Then let him be returned to his own tribe. There are Americani at the oil rigs in Dhahran, someone said.
Faraj nodded his agreement and quoted the famous proverb of Father Noah.
The plowman to the plowwoman, the retainer to the retainer woman, and the slave to the slave woman, to each according to his own.
There were mutters around the tent. The shadows of the men danced against the tent walls in the firelight, as though they were engaged in some ancient pagan rite.
There has been heavy fighting in that area since the border dispute. The Ingalizi are so stupid they cannot tell a Ruwala noble from a Hatem slave. They would think we were brigands and shoot at us, said Safuk, a beardless man who was the husband of Faraj's daughter.
Although his words were cautious, Yusef whispered to Nick that Safuk was the best marksman among the Mutayir.
King Abd al-Aziz has forbidden any but the Suluba to visit the foreign kafirs. The Mutayir are loyal to the House of Saud, said Faisal, a handsome youth who was Zayed's oldest son.
Even so, Zayed murmured.
Besides, Faisal declared proudly, I would sooner die than be taken for a Suluba Sani.
Asani was a member of a vassal tribe, Yusef explained to Nick. The Sunna tribes had to pay a quawa to a noble tribe like the Mutayir. But Sunna like the Hitaim or the Suluba were inviolate from attack. Like women, they were considered creatures too inferior to fight.
But what would the Dimi's status be?
Bandar declared, bewildered at the turn of events.
You should learn mercy, my brother's son, Zayed said sadly.
He tossed his cigarette into the glowing coals.
According to the hadith of Bukhari from Usama ibn Zayed, God has no mercy on those who do not have mercy.
What's a hadith?
Nick whispered in Yusef's ear.
A hadith is a saying or action of the Prophet Muhammad, the messenger of God. The sunnah or practices of the Prophet guide us in all things. Since some hadith are more authentic than others, my father always cites his sources,
Yusef whispered back.
So the boy stays, Faraj said.
His kismet has brought him to us. Allah does the writing. We are merely the readers. Perhaps we can bring him to the truth,
Zayed said, patting Nick's head. He gazed seriously into Nick's eyes.
Would you like to stay with us, little scorpion?
Zayed asked. Nick didn't know what to say. He was very confused. He remembered how Zayd had knelt by his dad and saved him from the Tsar. Grown-ups knew what to do. He was just a kid. But Zayd's eyes were warm when he looked at Nick. It reminded him of the way Mom looked at him sometimes, and Dad on the plane. He nodded.
"So be it," Zayd sighed. "Listen, little scorpion. From now on, you are a Bedu of the Mutayir, of the family of Zayd ibn Bushir of the Alamash, son of Abdullah, the son of the great Sheikh Dushan. Do you understand?"
Nick shook his head and yawned again. It was very confusing.
"Well," Zayd laughed, "understanding will come when it comes."
Later, Nick woke in the night. Everyone was asleep. He lay bundled in a camel robe, listening in the darkness. Outside the tent, he could hear the wind singing on the sands. He wondered if it would blow the sand over his dad. Then he slept.
Moscow. The dossier lay on the desk in a pool of light cast by the lamp. The top page was stamped in bold letters. It read, "Top State Secret, for Politburo only. Source, KGB Directorate 5. No copies to be made." It was a remarkable document, Svetlov thought. He wearily massaged his closed eyes with his fingers, blue-white spots swimming across the darkness. Clipped to the top page was a deciphered telex. It confirmed the worst. Those bungling Arab scum had let the scorpion slip through their fingers a second time. Now, after reading Directorate 5's dossier, he understood why. The scorpion was no ordinary agent. He picked up the report and studied it again for a few minutes. It was based on CIA records and provided an incomplete history of the American agent up to his recent gun-running episode in Afghanistan. The American record ended with the curious computer notation, "Delete from files. Initiate global record search and purge." That meant the CIA didn't even want their own people to know about him. He drummed his fingers nervously on the padded desktop. He had to assume that the scorpion already knew about the planned assassination. The disposition of the Arab's body in the department store toilet in Doha indicated that the American had had time to question him. Whether the scorpion learned enough to interfere or not was debatable. On principle, he had to assume the worst. He had learned never to count on luck. As his grandmother used to say, "Roast pheasant won't fly into your mouth." Question: could the plan succeed without the element of surprise? Like most Russians, Svetlov thought of the Arabs as Chernomazi, niggers. If there was a way of pissing in the soup, the Arabs would find it, he thought. What complicated the issue was that they couldn't just send in KGB teams to terminate this scorpion. Russians would be as conspicuous in Arabia as blackbirds in a snowfield. They would have to use Palestinians, he decided. Chernomazi. They only had to delay the scorpion for another 72 hours. If the Palestinians killed him, so much the better, he thought, pleased with the idea of a countermove to present to Fyodorenko to offset the news about the scorpion's second escape. Although it was 2 a.m., Fyodorenko was sure to still be in his office, he thought, slipping the dossier into his briefcase. Fortunately, Svetlov was in his office in the great Kremlin palace and not at KGB headquarters, that yellow monstrosity with the Stalinist wedding cake facade on Dzerzhinsky Square. Svetlov had long ago learned the virtue of staying close to the Kremlin. Now he didn't have far to go. He closed the door to his office, located in a corridor off St. George's Hall, and headed towards the octagon-shaped Hall of St. Vladimir with its cathedral ceilings. At every door, silent Kremlin guards snapped to attention before opening the door for him. He went down the stairs and crossed Upper Savior Square. Despite the fact that it was June, the night was still very cool and clear. The stars burned with a cold white fire, and his footsteps made the only sound. He felt very alone. He entered the Terem Palace at the front hall chamber entrance and passed through the cross chamber to the throne room.
a gilded chamber with mosaic-tiled walls, its parquet floor covered with a thick wine-red carpet. Floor-to-ceiling windows stretched along the courtyard side of the chamber, where Tsarist petitioners used to stand in line. Lamplight was reflected in the window panes. Where once the Tsar himself had sat, Fyodorenko was at work behind a massive desk big enough to be used to land carrier jets, Svetlov mused. Fyodorenko looked up warily.
"Forgive the intrusion, comrade. I come to present the report personally," Svetlov began.
Fyodorenko nodded. As always, his face gave nothing away. Svetlov stood uneasily before the desk like a schoolboy summoned to the principal's office.
"The Arabs have bungled this scorpion business again. We'll have to move quickly. I've already sent a copy of the scorpion's dossier via our contact to Prince Abdul Saad," Svetlov said, placing the report on Fyodorenko's desk.
"Send Marshal Orlov to me," Fyodorenko said, his bloodless lips barely moving.
"Are we mobilizing, comrade?" Svetlov asked breathlessly.
"It's time to move the pieces into position for the center board game," Fyodorenko said.
"I have to warn you about the scorpion. According to the stolen CIA report, he spent his entire childhood studying the Arab culture," Svetlov said.
Fyodorenko gazed at the fragmented image of the room reflected in the petition window. When he finally turned back towards Svetlov, his eyebrows were arched and a ghostly smile hovered at the corners of his mouth.
"What did he do after the first 20 minutes? Asked an amused Fyodorenko.
Arabia, 1951. In the gray light of the false dawn that precedes the sun, Nick woke to the groans of the camels as they shuffled by outside the tent. Their forelegs hobbled so they couldn't stray. Ifat, a large pudgy woman with a voice like brass and good-humored eyes outlined by coal, brought him a white cotton robe called a taub and gestured for him to put it on. His shirt and pants were gone. He put on the taub. It belonged to Yusef and was too big for him. She laughed and told him he would grow into it. Outside, the boys were driving the camels to the nearest bushes for forage. Old Mohammed gave the call to prayer, his breath like smoke in the cool morning air.
"God is most great. I testify that there is no God but God. I testify that Mohammed is the prophet of God. Come to prayer, come to salvation. Prayer is better than sleep. God is most great. There is no God but God."
Sheikh Zayed was by the water skins. They were made of goat skins and quivered obscenely on the sand like giant, bloated leeches. Zayed was washing his face, hands, and feet before prayer. Ifat gave Nick a twig to brush his teeth with. He watched as the men of the tribe smoothed the sand with their hands and lined up their prayer rugs and bowed their foreheads to the ground, reciting the dawn prayer in unison. "In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful." Yusef came over and translated for Nick. "Allah was God," he said. "Allah was God's name, just as his name was Nick or Little Scorpion. You made a ruku bow when you prayed. Formal prayer was called salat. You performed salat 5 times a day, first at dawn, then at noon. The noon salat was called zuhr. In the afternoon, salat was called ashr. The dusk salat was maghrib, and the night salat was isha. Salat was one of the 5 pillars of Islam," Yusef explained. "The others were shahada, the confession that there is only one God and no other, and that Muhammad is the prophet of God. The zakat, which is the giving of charity. The siyam, which is the fasting during the holy month of Ramadan. And the hajj, which is the pilgrimage to the holy Kaaba in Mecca." As the blazing sun rose into the sky, empty of clouds, the women pounded coffee beans in a brass mortar, the pestle ringing against the mortar like a bell. Breakfast was pita bread and goat cheese with sweet tea called shay. Nick was still hungry after breakfast. Yet he noticed that even though the others must have been hungry, they refused seconds. Later he learned that food was often scarce, and that the feast of the previous night was a celebration of their victory over the Tsar, and to honor him because he was a stranger. A guest must always be offered hospitality, even if he is an enemy and you have to slaughter your last camel to feed him. After tea, Faraj's wife, Johara, a fat woman wearing a black milfa veil over her face, served a very thick black coffee spiced with cardamom called awa. Each man was served in turn in order of precedence. Nick, being the youngest, was served last. Johara poured a thimbleful into a tiny cup. Each man slurped loudly as he drank. It was bad manners to drink more than three cups. Also, you were supposed to belch after you had eaten. Nick laughed at that, picturing Gran's horror at all the burping. After breakfast, the boys went off to tend the camels, while the girls stayed to clean up and work at household chores. The boys rode the camels, shouting to each other in loud voices that could be heard for miles in the clear air of the desert. But there was no roughhousing. For one Arab to grab or strike another was unthinkable. Nick tried to mount a camel. Grabbing a tassel hanging from the saddle, he tried to pull himself up as he had seen the other boys do. Sweat blinded his eyes and he fell off. Everyone laughed. His face burned and he kept trying but couldn't do it till Yusef helped him. Yusef was his friend. All that day, Yusef taught him how to speak Arabic. In the days that followed, everyone he spoke to corrected him and taught him. He learned at an astonishing rate, as though his mind had been a car idling along in first gear, suddenly pushed into overdrive. Even Sheikh Zayed remarked at his ability. Arabic was very different from English, Nick learned. The most important difference was that everything was either masculine or feminine. The way you said something depended on the gender of the person saying it, the gender of the person you were talking to, and the gender of the thing itself. Any word associated with a thing, such as an adjective or a number, was also modified to reflect the gender and number. Usually, if a word ended with A, it was feminine.
"Why is everything male and female?" Nick asked Yusef.
"Look at the world and show me what is not male or female," Yusef said.
"What about things like rocks or tents?"
"That's the hard part," Yusef said with a laugh. That afternoon, Safouk began to teach Nick how to hold a rifle. The old British Enfield 303 was bigger than Nick, and he could barely raise it. Safouk held it for him as Nick squeezed off his first shot at a nearby tamarisk tree. The recoil bumped his chin, and he began to whimper.
"Crying is not the way of men. If you cry, you should not shoot," Safouk said, and Nick choked back the tears.
That evening, he asked Sheikh Zayed if he wasn't too little to learn to shoot. He was afraid everyone would laugh at him because he couldn't lift the rifle. To be laughed at was a dishonor.
"You are Bedou now. All Bedou can shoot," Zayed said.
"But why is it so important?" Nick asked.
Zayed looked down at the boy with some surprise.
"A man who is not a warrior might as well be a woman."
Yusef and Nick became inseparable. One evening after the Maghrib prayers, they swore to be brothers forever. Yusef gave Nick his Kanjar dagger. The hilt was made of silver and the blade was shiny steel. Nick gave Yusef the only things he still owned, his Boy Scout knife and his shoes. The shoes were too small, but Yusef wore them unlaced and proudly hobbled around. From then on, Nick went barefoot like everyone else. The first time he tried to walk barefooted on the hot sand, the pain seared his feet. It was like walking on hot coals. He hopped around like an awkward dervish, and even austere old Muhammad smiled at the sight. He tried to keep up, but soon lagged further behind the others. Faisal offered him a pair of sandals, but the boy refused. His face screwed tight with pain and something else. Something in his strange gray eyes that made Faisal back away. Faisal had seen the same savage glare in the eyes of his father's falcon. It was then that the legend began, because unlike any other kafir, the little scorpion somehow managed to keep up, limping silently into camp. Ifat bathed his scorched and blistered feet with mineral water and looked at the child with wondering eyes. Eventually, his tender feet became calloused and impervious to pain. For the rest of his life, he felt uncomfortable wearing shoes. Little by little, he learned the harsh ways of the Bedou. he learned to be impervious to the pangs of hunger and thirst, to push his body far beyond what he ever thought his body could do. Weather no longer mattered. It was never discussed. He grew indifferent to the intense noonday heat when the sun baked down on the blazing plain as on a frying pan. He learned to sleep in his clothes in the icy chill of night, the darkness blazing with a million diamond chips that were stars, as the temperature plummeted by 100 degrees in a matter of hours. Pain and discomfort were weaknesses to be mastered, even as the body's pleasures were gifts from Allah to be indulged.
The body is but a receptacle for the spirit, like the sheath for a shining sword, Sheikh Zayed would say. Sheikh Zayed gave him a thelul, a good-riding she-camel. Her name was Jidda, and she soon grew as faithful to him as a dog and would come when he called in his boyish soprano. Faisal taught him to ride. He learned to mount her and ride with his leg around the saddle pommel, how to spur her on with a cry and a touch from his whip, and how to make her stop and kneel by crooning "Grr" from deep in his throat. Riding a camel at a walking pace, which was most common, was like constantly being jerked from a standstill on a sled resting on rough ground. There were many painful falls, but the bruised boy would always remount, his face set like stone. Faisal wondered at the scorpion's tenacity.
"It is as if the boy knows he is preparing for battle," Faisal said to his father, after seeing the scorpion climb back up the thalul's neck and perch on the saddle, his leg hooked around the pommel like a monkey's tail around a branch.
"He is Allah's Khalifa, God's deputy, although he does not know it. Only Allah knows what is written for him," Sheikh Zayed replied in a troubled voice. Silently, they watched the scorpion chase after the other riders. Even harder was riding at a trot or a gallop. To preserve their bottoms from a terrible pounding, the mutayir rode squatting, not sitting. The position required an extraordinary sense of balance, and it took the scorpion a long time to master it. One day Yusef challenged Nick to a race. The boys spurred their camels to a gallop across a vast salt flat, blinding white as snow in the sun and rimmed by Arad salt bushes, which were good forage for camels. Nick called to Jidda, and the she-camel burst into the lead, her long neck stretched out. She held her head up elegantly, like a proper English lady's pinky when sipping tea. The warm wind pressed against the folds of his ta'ub, like an embrace. He felt a surge of exultation, of wild freedom, a boy's dream of heaven come true. When at last they reined in their camels, Nick's face was flushed with triumph. He had never been so happy. Faisal taught him to ride using only his feet and verbal commands to guide the camel, so that he would have his hands free for fighting. He learned to be a dead shot even while riding at a gallop. Safuk taught him how to feint, slash, and thrust with the curved sword and the kanjar dagger. Soon, while rolling on the ground, he was able to throw the kanjar at a tamarisk tree from 20 paces and hit a spot no bigger than a man's palm. "Your enemy will attack you when you least expect him. You must always be ready, for there will be no time to prepare. And you must do the same when you attack him. In fighting, surprise is everything," Safuk said. But learning to survive in the desert meant more than fighting. He learned to navigate in the desert by the stars at night and by the position of the sun during the day, to always know where he was by distinguishing 1,000 tiny landmarks in the almost featureless desert, until he could do it as unthinkingly as a Westerner driving a car across town. He learned to see across the immense emptiness so that he could tell by a barely visible puff of dust on the horizon who or what it was, how many riders and from what tribe, friend or foe. He learned to find his way to distant wells hidden in the sands. When the mutayir broke camp and moved to find a new well or grazing, they could never be sure that they would find it or that it hadn't run dry since the last time. And if they made a mistake, there was no second chance. The desert never forgave. "In the desert, the penalty for a mistake is death," Sheikh Zayed would say. And yet, they never really feared. Everything was in Allah's hands anyway. Almost every statement was accompanied by the phrase, "Inshallah," God willing. He learned to track and hunt with a rifle and the falcon.
a Bedou had to know the tracks of every desert animal and of every horse and camel. After a time, Nick could tell by the track of a camel whether it was wild or tame, male or female, whether it was carrying a rider, where it came from, how tired it was, and even whose camel it was. Camels from the Sandy Nafud had soft soles. Those from the rocking plains of the Najd left smooth tracks, their soles polished by friction with the ground. From the droppings, you could tell how old the track was, what the camel had been grazing on, and when it had been watered last, and from these signs deduce where it came from and where it was going. And the dried droppings could be used for fuel. Nothing was ever wasted. The desert gave little. It forced a man back upon himself simply in order to survive. Sheikh Zayed said that it was no accident that Allah had revealed himself in the desert. It was the desert's very emptiness, its nothingness of stone and sand and sky, which mirrored the perfection of the Creator. Once Nick asked Sheikh Zayed how he knew there was a God. Zayed reined in his camel and outstretched an arm at the vast empty plain and burning sky.
"No defect canst thou see in the creation of the God of mercy," Zayed declared harshly in the words of the Holy Quran. "Repeat the gaze. Seest thou a single flaw?"
By then, Nick had grown conversant in Arabic. At first he translated everything into English. Later he simply thought in Arabic without ever translating. He realized he was fluent when he found himself dreaming in Arabic. It was a language of incredible subtleties and shadings of meaning. Hidden in every phrase was a treasure house of ambiguities and implications. Every word came from a root, usually made up of three consonants. Vowels, prefixes, and suffixes were inserted to provide special meaning in grammatical context. Thus, words with widely diverse meanings were all derived from the same root and often implied each other. He discovered that the art of conversation consisted not so much in surface communication as in the exploration of the metaphors, which are the only ways that human beings can truly communicate. Unlike Westerners who were concerned with apparent reality, Arabs, by virtue of the very language in which they thought, turned the most ordinary conversation into the abstractions of poetry. Arabs were not so much interested in facts as in truth, which is quite another thing. The harshness of the desert forced a discipline among the Bedou. Their lives were bound by many rules. It was forbidden to drink alcohol or eat pork, to converse with women outside your family, or even for a man to approach his wife during her time of the month. Yet the Mutayir never spanked their children, nor did a man ever beat his wife. Those were abominations. All that it ever took to discipline Nick and the other children was a reminder of how intimately bound together their lives were. If a boy did something wrong, he would be told, "That is not the Mutayir way." Once, Yusef stood up after the iftar, which is the dinner that breaks the day-long fast throughout the holy month of Ramadan, without belching. It was a terrible breach of etiquette, comparable to a Western boy spitting out his food in a restaurant. Sheikh Zayed looked at him with disgust and said, "Because of your bad manners, I am ashamed to sit with my brothers. I wonder if you wouldn't rather be a Hutaymi instead of a Mutayir." Zayed stalked out of the tent, and Yusef followed, his head hanging in shame. Real learning among the Bedou was accomplished by telling stories. Once Bandar, who was Nick's enemy and never passed Nick without a sneer or a muttered word, snuck up behind Jidda and jammed his dagger between the she-camel's hind legs. Jidda bucked wildly as a bronco, tossing Nick to the ground. Nick rolled to his feet and grabbed Jidda by the lip. He calmed her and, wadding his kafiyah headcloth into a bulky bandage, used it to stem the camel's bleeding. Bandar stood by, laughing. "Touch her again, and I will forget that you are of the Dar al-Islam, the House of Islam, against whom fighting is forbidden," Nick said, his gray eyes smoky with anger. "Raya," Bandar hissed. Raya were human cattle, the lowest form of infidel. Suddenly, Sheikh Zayed came up and glanced at the two angry boys. He had noticed Bandar's constant abuse of the boy, yet the little Dimi always kept his temper. Even though he was only a child, he seemed to know that revenge was a dish best tasted cold. "It can come to no good. I'd hate to be Bandar when the boy has grown to manhood," Zayed thought.
he murmured the old saying, "May Allah make the end better than the beginning."
"Did you hurt the Sheikh Hamam, my brother's son?" Zaid asked.
Bandar's face flushed, and he looked away, his bad eye faintly twitching. Once again, the little Dimi had caused him shame. Sheikh Zaid raised his hand as though surrendering, something he often did when quoting a hadith of the Prophet.
"The Messenger of God said, while a man was walking on a road, his thirst grew strong. He found a well and descended into it and drank and was leaving when he saw a dog with its tongue hanging out, licking the ground from thirst. And the man said, 'This dog's thirst is like the thirst I had,' and he went into the well again, filled his shoe with water and gave the dog to drink. And Allah approved of his act and pardoned his sins. They said, 'What, Messenger of God, shall we be rewarded for what we do for animals?' He replied, 'Yes, there is a reward on every living creature,' Zaid said."
Later, Zaid took Nick aside. They walked through a field of stone shingles outside the camp.
"It is good you swallow your anger. Bandar is your father's brother's son. But beware how you nourish your revenge. The scorpion, after whom you are named, has a deadly sting. It is said that a trapped scorpion may sting itself rather than be defeated," Zaid said.
"I don't understand," Nick said.
"Sometimes a man is slain by his own weapon, by the very thing he uses to protect himself," Zaid explained.
"Tell that to Bandar," Nick said.
Every Bedou loved stories, especially the tales of adventure. Often at night, after the recitation from the Quran, they would sit around the glowing coals in Sheikh Zaid's tent and listen to old Muhammad tell the famous tales of the Rawi storytellers. He told of the fabulous Omani sailor Sinbad, who sailed from Muscat to the ends of the earth, and of Khalid ibn al-Walid, the Muslim general who faced the 50,000 Byzantine troops of the Emperor Heraclius at the Battle of the Yarmouk. The Byzantines swore to stand or die, and to prove it, they chained themselves together in ranks 30 deep, shouting, "Allah Akbar!" The Arabs attacked the emperor's soldiers, who fell like ripe wheat under the flashing swords of the Bedouin. Heraclius, his army chopped to pieces in the narrow wadi, fled to Constantinople. The Muslims went on to conquer the Holy Land. But of all the tales, Nick's favorite was of Antar, the Bedouin warrior of the 6th century. The son of a Bedou sheikh and a black female slave, Antar was dark of skin and born of servitude. But he showed courage and won his freedom in battle. Antar rode a black stallion faster than the wind and fought the oppressors of the weak and the poor with his powerful sword. "With my sword will I destroy the oppressors. Let Allah's justice fall on me as he wills," Antar vowed. Once Antar faced an army of 40,000 single-handed. His glittering sword scattered them like chaff in the wind. But no man is invincible. The great warrior was vanquished by a woman, the beautiful dark-eyed virgin, Abla, daughter of a great sheikh. "The eyelashes of my beloved from the corner of her veil are more cutting than the edges of sharp scimitars," swore Antar. The fire burned low in the tent, and even the wind fell silent, as in a hushed voice, Muhammad told of Antar's battle with the fiercest lion in the desert. "To prove his love for the fair virgin Abla, Antar vowed to fight the lion," Muhammad said.
"Ya Allah,"
breathed Yusef, his eyes wide and full of wonder. Nick took Yusef's hand. The two boys longed to be like Antar.
"But to prevent Antar from escaping the wrath of the lion, his feet were bound by his terrible enemy, Munzar."
"May the raiders get him," cried a voice in the darkness.
The lion crouched and sprang, looming larger than the biggest camel. But Antar leapt into the air and cleaved the beast in two with his sword, Muhammad declared.
"Ya Allah,"
Nick murmured. Like Antar, he too came from a despised background. But his courage might yet win him honor, he thought. Antar was his hero.
Al-Arama. In the cool shade, lulled by the gurgling sound of the water as it tumbled down over the rocks to the crystal pond, Abdul Sa'ad tried to return his thoughts to the infinite, the center. Reclining on his prayer rug after the afternoon salat, he inhaled deeply of the fragrance of the garden. As he glanced at the tall palms, the wildflowers and watered greens, he recited aloud the poetry of the Holy Quran. Reclining there upon soft couches, they shall feel neither the scorching heat nor the biting cold. Trees will spread their shade around them, and fruits will hang in clusters over them. They shall be served with silver dishes, and cups brimful of ginger water from the fount of Selsabil. He loved this peaceful oasis, which sat in the middle of his country fortress, surrounded by thousands of armed troops, like the eye of a hurricane. How many millions had it cost him? It mattered not the blink of a gnat's eye. Yet like the gnat, this scorpion intruded on his serenity. With a sigh, Abdul Sa'ad turned his mind back to the report from Moscow. Those clumsy Russians had all the subtlety of a sledgehammer, he thought. Their crude Tartar mentality understood nothing of the interplay of plot and counterplot, the intricacies of the arabesque. They had the same answer for everything, more guns. The Americans were just as crude, worse. They hadn't even the excuse of being godless barbarians like the Russians. To the Americans, everything was money. They were like spoiled children. Allah had been too kind to them. He remembered his first trip to America when he was in his teens. They took him to see Niagara Falls. He stood open-mouthed, his eyes wide as saucers. "When do they turn it off?" he had asked, unable to imagine that such a torrent of fresh water could be anything other than man-made. He remembered how his face burned as they all laughed. "Never," they had said. All he knew in that very instant, that Allah had damned them with an abundance that made them weak. Then they tried to corrupt Arabia with their evil. But he would show them the way. He plucked a sugared fig from a silver bowl and chewed it thoughtfully. Nothingness and sweetness, that is Islam. At the heart of the labyrinth is emptiness and submission, absolute purity of thought and physical sensuality. Allah had plucked him out, even as he had plucked the fig from the bowl. Nuruddin had twice failed to destroy the scorpion because he had not understood the nature of his enemy. An unusual mixture, this scorpion, half Bedou and half American. But was this scorpion a romantic who liked running around in a flowing sheet? Or was he truly dangerous? According to Moscow's report, the scorpion was a Muslim. That meant he was committed and therefore dangerous. He had lived as a Christian with the Bedou for years and only then converted. How very odd, Abdul Sa'ad mused. Arabia, 1956. Nick had been living with the Mutayir for nearly 5 years when war broke out between Egypt and Israel. They first heard the news in the souk in Al-Hasa, where he had gone with Sheikh Zayed, who wanted to buy some gold jewelry. The gold was for Faisal, so that he could offer a mutra, the bridal price he would have to pay in order to marry his cousin, Madawi. Sheikh Zayed held up a gold necklace. It gleamed like burning coals in the sunlight. "How do you know it's real gold?" Nick asked. "If you don't know the thing, you must know the man," Zayed replied. "Ya Amaimi, weigh and judge, for gold cannot lie," cajoled the gold seller. Sheikh Zayed drew a touchstone from the folds of his bisht and lightly rubbed the necklace against the stone. "It is by testing that we discern fine gold, and more than gold. As is the mold, so will the cast be," Zayed explained to Nick. "Behold, it is as you say," he said to the gold seller. A battered, colorfully painted Chevrolet rumbled down the dusty street, scattering goats and chickens. "Devil machines," muttered the gold seller.
Soon these foreign machines will drown out the cry of the falcon in the desert, Zaid said, his face troubled.
The gold seller clapped his hands and ordered cups of sweet hot chai from a passing vendor. It was as the two men sipped and haggled over the price that the news swept the souk, like the breath of hot wind which warns of a coming sandstorm. Sheikh Zaid was thunderstruck. It was inconceivable that Arabs, even the slavish Egyptian fellaheen, could be swept out of Sinai in only a few days by the lightning attack of the Jews.
They have won a battle, not the war. Some day we will push them back into the sea, Zaid said. What? And pollute the sea? The gold seller laughed.
On the ride back to their camp, Nick pulled his camel alongside Sheikh Zaid and they discussed it.
Are we to hate the Jews? Nick asked.
Sheikh Zaid frowned. The world was changing in ways that were difficult to understand. For a time his gaze was lost in the distant burning plain.
That gold seller was wrong to curse them so, Zaid said at last. The sons of Isaac and the sons of Ishmael are both the sons of Father Ibrahim. Ours is a family quarrel. But they are wrong to steal the dirah of the Philistine. Without his dirah, how can a man live? Until they return the land, there can be no peace.
They are good fighters, though, Nick said.
It must be admitted. The Jews are exceedingly difficult to get rid of, Zaid said with a rueful smile, urging his camel on.
They stopped for the night in a vast sandy plain. As the sun set in a brilliant slash of red, Zaid performed the maghrib. They ate pita bread and dried meat and brewed coffee over a fire made of camel chips. The night was cool and clear, and a crescent moon hung like a silver pendant in the starry sky. Zaid, troubled by what had happened, spoke of the Jews in a quiet voice as they reclined around the glowing embers.
Honor is due to the Jews. They are the people of the book. They were the first to whom God revealed the truth that he is one. Any religion that does not recognize this is not a religion, merely superstition. Their prophets, Father Ibrahim, Moses, Samuel, and Isaiah were true prophets. Muhammad, the messenger of God, was simply the last of the prophets, hence he is called the seal of the prophets. But the Jews fell away from God, first because they whored after other gods in golden calves, and then because they virtually deified their law. Also, their concept of being a chosen people is repugnant. All men are equal in God's eyes. No priest or saint is a hair's breadth closer to the Lord of the worlds than any ordinary man. No race or people is a particle holier than any other. One of the prophet's wives was black, and he gave his daughter in marriage to a black. Any other teaching is not religion, it is bigotry. Another failing of the Jews is that they rejected Jesus, who was a true prophet, who called upon men to love each other as brothers. But the Nazarenes also perverted the teachings of Jesus. They taught that God is three, not one, and that Jesus was his son, begotten of a human female. And the Nazarenes have such strange ideas, such as original sin. How can anyone look at the innocent newborn babe and say that he is guilty of Adam's sin? The very idea is absurd. Every man's sin is his own, and no other. If we are not responsible for our own actions, justice has no meaning. They compound the error by confusing this original sin with sex. That too is absurd. Lawful sex is good. If it were not so, God would not have made it pleasurable, Zaid said with a smile. Islam is otherwise. With us there are no miracles to excite the superstitious. The messenger of God, peace be upon him, insisted that he never performed a single miracle except for the improbability of an unlettered man, such as himself, producing the poetic glory that is the Holy Quran. Islam is based on man's experience and his reason. If you seek miracles, look for yourself, Zaid cried harshly, pointing up at the star-scattered night. Look! Only a fool would cry for a sign when creation harbors nothing else.
The fire burned low. There was no wind, and the camels were still. It was a moment of perfect silence, such as God himself must have known in the moments before creation, Nick thought. They lay silently for a long time, each of them alone with his thoughts. Nick's mind whirled. His heart burned with thoughts and desires like a furnace. Yet Zaid's words, like the night, were so clear.